is bound to lose.
I said,
all your flesh is bound to lose.
Yes,
all your flesh is bound to lose. You're bound to lose, your flesh is bound to lose.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, March 23rd edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, we'll have Gil Halstead's interview of Salvadoran American Marco Aguirre. Aguirre lives in Madison, and his father lives in Arquitao, El Salvador. He's had personal experience with family and friends who have suffered at the hands of those incarcerated by El Salvador's president, Bukele, who calls himself a cool dictator. We'll hear that about half past the hour. But first, we have the news.
Many Christian evangelical groups backed Donald Trump's election because of abortion policy, but they were also instrumental in creating George W. Bush's President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which is estimated to have prevented some 25 million early deaths. Now these groups are pressing the Trump administration to rescue PEPFAR from its cuts to foreign assistance. The U.S. Department of State has said that the PEPFAR program is already exempt from the cancellation. Unfortunately, the program relied heavily on logistical support from the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, which has been effectively decimated by cuts. Galen Carey, Vice President of Government Relations at the National Association of Evangelicals, called on the administration to save PEPFAR before it is too late. Matthew Loftus, a doctor and evangelical Christian working at a mission hospital in Kenya, said the damage was already being done. He said, "Once you stop taking ARVs, within days the virus can come back online and then start developing resistance." Loftus continued, "I hear stories from old missionaries. They talk about wards full of people with AIDS dying all the time. That's part of the fear looking ahead."
Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwa was sworn in as Namibia's first woman president last Friday after winning elections in November with 58% of the vote. She's a member of the Southwest Africa People's Organization, or SWAPO, party, which she joined at 14 when it was a liberation movement resisting South Africa's white minority rule. In her inauguration speech, Nandi-Ndaitwa said tackling unemployment was a priority, acknowledging the 44% unemployment of 18 to 34-year-olds. She told reporters, quote, "In the next 5 years, we must produce at least 500,000 jobs," unquote. She said developing education, agriculture, fishing, and the creative and sports industries as key sectors for job creation would require an investment of close to $5 billion. She also acknowledged the problem of land ownership in Namibia. Government statistics show that white farmers, less than 2% of the country's population, own about 70% of its farmland. She would like to see that change, but also said that she is committed to the willing buyer, willing seller principle, which means no one is forced to sell.
A report by Human Rights Watch, released Wednesday, called on Pakistan to stop forcing Afghan refugees back to their neighboring home country, where the ruling Taliban enforces repressive policies for women and girls, and where almost half the population requires emergency food aid. At the start of 2025, Afghanistan had a total refugee population of 6.4 million, one of the world's largest. Since the Taliban took control of Afghanistan in 2021, 1.6 million Afghans have fled to Pakistan and Iran. In late 2023, Pakistan stepped up efforts to expel Afghans and has set a deadline of March 31st for all illegal Afghan residents to go home. Widespread reports of police abuse have also been associated with the residency crackdown. The Human Rights Watch reports recommendations also call on concerned governments to fund health services, including mental health services, in Afghanistan. Additionally, governments should be increasing resettlement efforts for refugees from Pakistan to third countries.
Despite the Canadian government's request for leniency, China recently executed 4 Canadian citizens for drug trafficking offenses. Canada condemned the executions but did not release details about the executed Canadians, honoring the request of their families. A statement from the Chinese government said, quote, "China always imposes severe penalties on drug-related crimes and maintains a zero-tolerance attitude toward the drug problem," unquote. A spokesperson at the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Mao Ning, insisted China is a country under the rule of law, handles cases fairly in strict accordance with the laws, and treats defendants of different nationalities equally without discrimination. Chinese executions of foreign nationals is rare, and its total annual number of executions is kept as a state secret. Human rights groups believe the number is in the thousands and one of the highest rates in the world. This is the most recent number of incidents between China and Canada, whose relationship is often described as icy.
Lawmakers in Mexico City voted on Tuesday to ban violent bullfighting. The legislation prohibits the killing of bulls during or after any bullfighting event and limits the time a single bull can be in the ring to just 15 minutes. Animal rights activists are celebrating the new law, although many believe the next step should be to outlaw bullfighting entirely. Following Tuesday's vote, Animal Heroes, an animal rights organization that has opposed bullfighting for years, released a statement saying, "Bloodless bullfighting is just the beginning. We will continue fighting until we achieve its total abolition." Supporters of traditional bullfighting say that it is an important part of Mexico's cultural history and an important piece of the country's tourist economy. According to the National Association of Breeders of Fighting Bulls in Mexico, the bullfighting industry supports 80,000 direct jobs and 146,000 indirect jobs across the country and generates more than $400 million each year. Previous bullfighting regulations in Mexico have been challenged in court and some overturned. Experts expect the lawsuits will be filed to challenge this new legislation as well.
Peru declared a state of emergency on Monday in response to an escalating wave of violent crime in Lima, the country's capital city. The move was prompted by the detonation of an explosive device that injured at least 11 people in a restaurant and the shooting of popular singer Paul Flores on his tour bus over the weekend. The government has reported more than 459 murders in 2025 so far, and almost 2,000 cases of extortion in January alone. The state of emergency is expected to last 30 days, in addition to suspending certain civil liberties, such as the right to assemble. The Peruvian military also announced the deployment of 1,000 troops to assist with security in Lima. Despite the additional security measures, many still report feeling unsafe in Lima. Pedro Quispe, a 48-year-old Lima resident, said, quote, "We've been abandoned and left to fend for ourselves. If you get on a bus, you can get shot. If you go to work, you can get asked for extortion payments," unquote.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said today that the 2015 nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPA, in its current form, is not in Iranians' interest, not revivable, and that Iran's nuclear capabilities have improved significantly. He stressed that his country will not enter into direct negotiations with the United States because the U.S. has proven a non-trustworthy treaty member. Iran was one of the original 62 signatories to the 1970 Non-Proliferation Treaty, the most important global treaty on the world's deadliest weapon. The Iranian minister's statements were in response to a letter from U.S. President Donald Trump to Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, expressing interest in a new nuclear agreement. President Trump gave Iran 2 months to reach a new nuclear agreement and warned it of the consequences of refusing to negotiate the new offer.
The French Foreign Ministry said in a statement that two French nationals working for the United Nations were seriously injured in Israeli airstrikes targeting two buildings housing UN staff in Gaza, which also resulted in the death of a UN ops staff member. Amid Israel's escalating violence in Gaza, the foreign ministers of Germany, France, and Britain called on Friday evening for a return to the ceasefire, warning of the repercussions of a resumption of Israeli airstrikes on Palestinian civilians. The Israeli military resumed airstrikes on Gaza while Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz threatened to annex parts of the Gaza Strip if Hamas did not release the remaining Israeli hostages. Israel launched a new offensive on besieged Gaza on Tuesday, breaking the relative calm since the ceasefire began on January 19th. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Neil with our first longer story.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwanda's President Paul Kagame met in Qatar on Tuesday with Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, Qatar's ruling emir. It was an informal discussion, although diplomats reported that both rulers had formally requested mediation for the talks. The purpose of the meeting was said to be to build trust rather than to resolve issues. The DRC and Rwanda reaffirmed their commitment to an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, but no details on how the ceasefire would be implemented or monitored. Their meeting was a surprise because much was made of a meeting arranged for the DRC government with the rebel militia M23 leaders in Angola. Rwanda's Kagame had refused to meet directly with DRC's Tshisekedi, saying that he must first meet with the M23 rebels. However, the M23 pulled out of Monday's meeting in Angola because earlier in the day, the EU sanctioned three of Rwanda's military commanders and the head of its state mining agency and five senior leaders of the M23 group, including its leader. According to the UN, the US, and the EU, the M23 is armed and commanded by Rwanda's army. Rwanda denies backing the group and says that the 4,000 Rwandan soldiers that fight with the M23 are there to ensure Rwanda's security. Rwanda has continued to maintain this position despite European, U.S., and U.N. suspension of development aid and export activities because of its participation in the conflict. The conflict in eastern DRC escalated in January when the Rwanda-backed M23 advanced and seized the strategic city of Goma, followed by Bukavu in February. Last month, the UN Human Rights Council launched a commission to investigate atrocities, including the allegations of rape and killing akin to, quote, summary executions, unquote, by both sides. The conflict has created one of the world's most significant humanitarian crises. More than 7 million people have been displaced, while 7,000 people have reportedly died since the start of the year. Will Qatar have some magic that brings all parties together and allows people to go home and live in peace?
The House Select Committee on China sent a letter this week to 6 university presidents requesting information about Chinese nationals who are students at the schools. A copy of the letter, dated March 18th and signed by committee chairman John Molinar, was released to the press. The letter laid out several major concerns to support the request, including national security, potential intellectual property theft, and the loss of opportunity for American citizens displaced by Chinese students. One of Chairman Molinar's statements in the letter said, quote, "The Chinese Communist Party has established a well-documented, systematic pipeline to embed researchers in leading U.S. institutions, providing them direct exposure to sensitive technologies with dual-use military applications," unquote. Another of Molinar's comments was, quote, "America's student visa system has become a Trojan horse for Beijing, providing unrestricted access to our top research institutions and posing a direct threat to our national security. If left unaddressed, this trend will continue to displace American talent, compromise research integrity, and fuel China's technological ambitions at our expense," unquote. At a daily briefing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said in response that Chinese students have helped, quote, "the economic prosperity and technological development of the U.S., unquote, and said of academic exchange, quote, "this is in the interest of both parties." Most Chinese students enrolled in U.S. undergraduate programs pay full tuition, making them an important source of funding for many universities. Spokesperson Ning also said, quote, "we urge the U.S. to stop overstretching the concept of national security, effectively protect the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese students, and not impose discriminatory restrictive measures on Chinese students," unquote. On March 14th, a group of Republican House members introduced the bill which would ban Chinese students from studying in American universities altogether. According to the Institute of International Education, there were more than 277,000 such students in the 2023-24 school year. But the bill is not expected to pass.
The United States Agency for Global Media, or USAGM, which oversees the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, among other international media outlets, is on the path to being eliminated by another of President Trump's executive orders. Last week, the head of Voice of America, Michael Abramowitz, posted on social media that more than 1,300 journalists, producers, and support staff at the Voice of America have been placed on administrative leave. It is widely expected that news coverage by the Voice of America will quickly stop to be replaced by music programming. The mission statement for USAGM dictates that its purpose is to inform, engage, and connect people around the world in support of freedom and democracy. It is guided by a nonpartisan 9-member board appointed by the president and includes the sitting Secretary of State. The USAGM's programs are intended to provide a source of information to citizens of other countries that have state-controlled media. Elon Musk posted on social media in February that the USAGM programs are, quote, "just radical left crazy people talking to themselves while torching $1 billion a year of U.S. taxpayer money," unquote, and called for them to be shut down. The Global Times, a daily English-language news outlet run by China's ruling Communist Party, applauded the move, printing, quote, "in recent decades, under the banner of promoting so-called freedom and democracy, it has broadcast in over 40 languages worldwide, attempting to shape the image of the U.S. as a moral high ground," unquote. On Tuesday, the Wall Street Journal published an opinion piece by William Galston of the Brookings Institute titled, "Defunding Voice of America is a Win for China and Iran." Galston says, quote, "Voice of America is one of the few fact-based news sources reaching China. In moments of crisis, such as the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, millions of Chinese have relied on Voice of America for the truthful accounts that they can't find in their own country's media," unquote. Radio Free Asia's president, Bei Feng, was quoted in The Guardian saying closing down the service was, quote, "a reward to dictators and despots, including the Chinese Communist Party, who would like nothing better than to have their influence go unchecked in the information space," unquote. Six Voice of America journalists filed a suit on Friday seeking to stop the shutdowns and seeking the reinstatement of a full-time staff and contractors.
The U.S. denied a special request for water to the Mexican city of Tijuana on Thursday under the 1944 U.S.-Mexico Water Sharing Treaty. The treaty governs the allocation of water in the Rio Grande and Colorado rivers by setting delivery obligations on both the U.S. and Mexico on five-year cycles, but has become strained in recent years due to drought and low water levels. According to some U.S. farmers and lawmakers, Mexico has waited until the end of each cycle to complete its obligations and came up short in the most recent cycle. In November of 2024, the Biden administration reportedly met with Mexican officials to discuss a solution to the growing problem. However, the Trump administration has taken up the issue as one of the latest battlefronts in U.S.-Mexico relations. The Colorado River is a major water source for both Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Approximately half of its water also goes to U.S. beef and dairy production. Tijuana, which has seen significant industrial and residential growth in recent years, also relies on the Colorado River for approximately 90% of its water supply. The city reports that significant waste due to outdated infrastructure contributes to the water shortage. Farmers and lawmakers on both sides of the border continue to express concern over the dwindling water supply as the climate crisis continues to escalate. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum announced that the issue is being dealt with, although no agreement has so far been reached. In a statement to reporters, she said, quote, "There's been less water. That's part of the problem," unquote.
A massive oil spill that began on March 13th has covered multiple rivers and impacted more than 500,000 residents in northwestern Ecuador. The spill is believed to have been caused by a landslide that ruptured a 310-mile pipeline operated by state-owned oil company Petroecuador. The pipeline transports up to 360,000 barrels of crude oil each day. Petroecuador has not yet released an official estimate of the volume of oil spilled. Many of those affected by the spill have been cut off from their fresh water supply due to concerns of contamination. Petroecuador, as well as some local authorities, have declared a state of emergency due to the ecological and humanitarian impact of the spill. According to Eduardo Robledo Monsalve of the Pontifical Catholic University of Ecuador, eyewitnesses reported a geyser of oil spewing from the pipeline for up to 7 hours. Monsalve has been canvassing the region following the spill and said, quote, "The entire southern shore of the Esmeraldas River is completely saturated with oil," unquote. He also reported that the Viche and Coplay rivers have turned anoxic, meaning the river ecosystems lack oxygen. The crude oil has been detected in at least 5 waterways. Ecuador's Ministry of Environment, Water, and Ecological Transition activated emergency funds to assist with disaster relief and issued a plea for environmental organizations to send volunteers to help with the cleanup. The ministry has also ordered Petroecuador to immediately commence containment and cleanup efforts. Oil spills in the region have long been a point of concern for authorities and environmental organizations. Between 2005 and 2022, 1,496 oil spills have been recorded in Ecuador, according to the Amazon Frontlines, a U.S.-based environmental nonprofit.
A Turkish court last Wednesday ordered Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu to be held in prison pending his trial on terrorism and corruption charges. Thousands of people continue to demonstrate across Turkey against what they call the undemocratic detention of the country's top opposition leader. İmamoğlu's party is the main opposition Republican People's Party, or CHP, which denounced his arrest as a political coup and smear campaign. He was arrested just days before the CHP was to announce İmamoğlu's nomination as its candidate in the 2028 presidential election. İmamoğlu denies the charges, calling them, quote, unimaginable accusations and slander, unquote. Internationally, Paris and Berlin, along with the mayors of several other major European cities, condemned İmamoğlu's arrest. Thousands of people gathered in front of the Istanbul municipality building and the main courthouse yesterday, with hundreds of police deployed at both locations. Arrests continued throughout the night, despite curfews in Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, and Antalya. Interior Minister Ali Yerkaya announced that approximately 343 people had been arrested. Yerkaya vowed that, quote, those who seek chaos and provocation will not be tolerated, unquote. In response to the protests, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was the mayor of Istanbul in the 1990s, vowed not to surrender to street terrorism. İmamoğlu and dozens of his co-defendants were escorted to Istanbul's courthouse today under a heavy security cordon of dozens of riot police trucks. İmamoğlu's lawyers said the hearing on the terrorism charge had concluded and the hearing on the corruption charge was scheduled to follow. İmamoğlu's arrest and trial and the protests directly impacted the stability of Turkish financial markets and its currency's exchange rate, especially given the close interconnectedness between politics and the economy in Turkey. Since the arrest, the value of the lira has continued to decline to the lowest since 2023. Ekrem İmamoğlu became a bitter rival of Erdogan after he won the mayor's seat of the country's economic capital, Istanbul, in 2019. He defeated the Justice and Democratic Party, or AK, candidate, who was backed by President Erdogan and who had served as mayor of Istanbul with the president's party for 25 years.
Israeli military forces resumed airstrikes in southern Lebanon yesterday, killing six people and wounding 11 others. The Israeli army initially struck Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon in response to three rockets fired from the area into northern Israel, which were intercepted by the Israeli defense dome. A second wave of Israeli strikes targeted the coastal city of Tyre and other areas in the southern and eastern Lebanon. One person was killed in Tyre and seven others were injured. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the rocket attacks. Hezbollah denied having any connection to the rocket fire and reaffirmed its commitment to the ceasefire agreement and its support for the Lebanese state. A ceasefire agreement reached on November 27 halted a two-month war between the Israeli army and the Lebanese Hezbollah fighters, who targeted Israel in support of Hamas. The Lebanese army said yesterday that it had conducted searches and inspections in the area where the rockets had been fired and recovered three primitive rocket launchers in the area north of the Litani River. Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam warned against rogue military operations on the southern border, which could drag the country into a new war. He said that, quote, the state alone has the power to decide war and peace, unquote. The UN Interim Force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, which is deployed in southern Lebanon, expressed concern about a potential escalation of violence and urged, quote, all parties to avoid undermining the progress achieved, unquote. Hezbollah rocket fire toward Israel began in solidarity with Hamas in October 2023, when Hezbollah was a key player in Lebanese political life. In September 2024, the cross-border exchange of fire escalated into an open war with airstrikes on Lebanon, particularly on Hezbollah strongholds, before a ceasefire was reached. By then, Israelis' violent attacks on Lebanon had killed more than 4,000 people, displaced hundreds of thousands, and caused massive destruction throughout Lebanon. The World Bank estimated the destruction at $14 billion.
And that's a wrap of the news from around the world for Sunday, March 23rd, 2025. I'm Lee Rowe.
I'm Andrew Karn.
I'm Neil Adams.
And the sources we used to prepare today's stories were ABC News, the Agence France-Presse, Al Jazeera, the Associated Press, Anadolu, CNN, France 24, The Global Times, The Guardian, IRNA, The Middle East Monitor, Mongabay, The New York Times, NPR, Reuters, and The Wall Street Journal.
Welcome to the Sunday, March 23rd edition of the Worldview feature. I'm your host, Gil Halstead. El Salvador has been in the headlines for the past week since the Trump administration deported more than 130 Venezuelans who are now being held in a huge prison 70 kilometers outside the Salvadoran capital of San Salvador. Trump says they're all members of a Venezuelan gang known as Tren de Aragua. This weekend, the chief federal judge for the Washington, D.C. District Court, Federal Judge James Boasberg, tried and failed to block the administration from carrying out this deportation. Now, to look a little bit more deeply at what is happening in El Salvador now and why the administration is sending deportees to this prison, we're joined by Marco Aguirre. Marco is originally from El Salvador, came to Wisconsin initially as a student, and got a degree at the University of Wisconsin in Platteville, moved to Madison. He's actually originally from Madison's Salvadoran sister city, Arquetao, and he visits his family there on an annual basis. And so he brings us an on-the-ground perspective of what is happening there now. So, Marco, welcome. Thanks for agreeing to talk with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So when exactly did you move to Madison?
Initially, I moved to Madison in 2010. And then I moved out for a few years to then return in 2019 permanently.
And your connection to the Arquetao Sister City Project, which we have focused on this project here on this program, usually once or twice a year, about the project that is going on down there and trips that are being taken. But how did you make the connection?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny, interesting story. My father is originally from Arquetao, which is the first sister city with Madison. And I was visiting Arquetao independently with my dad, and I saw a picture of the sister city and people visiting Arquetao. And it was just funny because I lived in Madison at the time. I had no idea that existed. And that's how I came back and introduced myself to the project.
And so you've been connected with it for a while. Have you actually been on some of the delegations that they have each year?
I've been not as part of the delegation, but I was already in El Salvador when they came and I joined them several times. So yeah, I've been involved since 2016, around that time.
So when did you last visit?
El Salvador, I was there in October last year.
Okay. And what were you hearing from friends and family there about Bukele's relationship, I guess the Trump administration hadn't quite started then, but with the Bukele administration, there's connection to the U.S. What were you hearing about what Bukele's doing there now?
So there was a very clear expectations that El Salvador's president was in favor of Trump getting reelected, and there was this sense that he cared mostly about the impression of being friendly to the U.S. government more than anything. People are concerned about the immigration policies. People are concerned about the rhetoric. But the government is very much trying their best to be friendly with the current administration.
And what do you hear there and what have you heard about the prison where these deportees are now supposedly being held along with thousands of other people? So Tell us about that prison, which has become, I don't know, notorious might be a word to use. What can you tell us about it?
There's a lot. Because my family still lives in El Salvador and I have a lot of friends. I grew up there. I've been hearing about it since it started getting built. The prison was a flagship project of this of El Salvador president as a way to say we're going to hold all the gang members and leaders in this max security prison. Throughout its existence, nobody has ever been able to go inside unless you're friendly with the government. Nobody has been able to verify prisoners' safety or anything in regards to the conditions of the prisoners. There's no access to media. There's no access to family, even of prisoners. And even before it became a thing with the U.S. administration, people were being sent there and you would have no news from them if you were a family of a prisoner. People would not know if they were there or not. Lawyers for these prisoners would not have access to them. So it's sort of a dark prison where people are just being held there without any sort of civil rights for a prisoner.
And it has been used since Bukele came to power. When exactly, get the time sequence here about how long Bukele has been the head of the government there.
So El Salvador is supposed to be, has a constitution that says the president can only be in power for 5 years, but he defied that. And now he's been reelected. Last year he was reelected. So he's been in power for 6 years now. He's in his second term. The prison was built during his tenure as president and is specifically built for this purpose.
Now, when we hear in the mainstream news, and one of the reasons that we've invited you to be on the program is that you wrote to us and said you think that sort of the typical news consumer here is not really getting the complete story, right, about what's happening there. And so because what we hear is that since the prison was built and since this big roundup of quote-unquote gang members and criminals that the Bukele administration has been carrying out, that many people in El Salvador, at least the ones out of prison anyway, are happier, that things seem safer. Is that accurate, and how does that fit?
I think there is a lot of, first of all, there's a lot of propaganda from the El Salvadorian government towards the international community about the measures that we're taking to reduce the violence in El Salvador. There is a story that we can go over if we had hours to talk about it. But the main point here is that the prison was built as a way to capture as many people as fast as possible in an effort to reduce violence in El Salvador. It was never meant to be a place where necessarily criminals were held, and it has been documented extensively that a lot of innocent people have been held under suspicion without any trial, without any sort of process. And not only they're being held, they're being kept from any process to be able to be released. And in fact, some of them might have gone through a judicial process to clear their name, and they've been clear, they've been ordered to be released, but because the government has complete control over all the branches of a Salvadorian government, they're not released and you can be held indefinitely there.
And so you have some concerns about the focus on immigration control here and these deportations that are going on. And in conversations we've had before, you say there's a big difference between sending someone back to their own country. I'm talking about the Venezuelans right now, who are here, came here from Venezuela, and now they're finding themselves in El Salvador instead of being sent back to Venezuela. Talk a little bit about that, about how that doesn't really seem to fit with fairness.
So the reason I write to you initially, and the reason why I think this is an extraordinary moment, is because I think immigrants have been commonly lumped into these, basically this group that broke the law and should be deported. And regardless of your opinion on immigration, whether you think immigration should be allowed or not, or you could be, it is a valid position to be against immigration. And I think that's a very different conversation to have to what is happening right now. The Venezuelan people that have been deported have been accused of being part of a gang called Tren de Aragua, which is number one, not been proven by any sort of process in the U.S. They were taken in a plane against the orders of the judge, as you said, and they were deported to another country that is not theirs, put in a prison that is known for torturing people, that is known for disappearing people. And I think even if you believe that these people should not be in the country, there's a very large stretch between believing they should be deported to their country of origin and to be sent to a prison where they would likely be held under very hard conditions.
And this seems to be the possibly the beginning of something that may get even bigger and include more people. I mean, I have not heard the outcome of this, but we just had news recently of a Venezuelan immigrant who arrived here a little over a year ago and had become established and had, I just got this information this morning, actually. He and his family were here. They had come across the border. They'd been given, actually, a temporary, what do you call it?
Status.
Yeah, a temporary asylum status of some kind. He had a job. The kids were starting a school. And suddenly ICE shows up at his house here in Madison and takes him away. This is just another individual who is also Venezuelan. So do you know anything about why these deportees are being sent to El Salvador rather than back to their country of origin? They didn't come from El Salvador. Is it really just because Bukele has made this offer and the U.S. is willing to pay to have to do this more conveniently than trying to figure out how to send them back to Venezuela?
I think part of the story that is not being told is that the current administration, and particularly the President Trump, believes that Venezuela is sending people to the States on purpose. I think he believes that people will be deported and they'll come right back. Now, there's another story where gang leaders from El Salvador were actually released from prison and were escaping with the El Salvadorian government permission to leave the country. And they were captured in Mexico and extradited to the U.S. Now, one of the curious things is that some of those gang leaders that know the El Salvador government has done very illegal things are being sent back to El Salvador along with the Venezuelan prisoners, which is everybody hears about the Venezuelan people being sent to El Salvador, but there's also Salvadorians being sent. And in El Salvador news and in El Salvador, people are making the connection that the U.S. is basically doing a tit for tat, giving them back people that El Salvador wanted with the condition that they take the Venezuelans. So it is a sort of under the table deal that they have going.
Yeah. And some of the news coverage I've read also, the kind of negotiations and sort of almost bribery going back and forth between the Bukele administration and gang leaders and gangs in El Salvador. I mean, people are being paid off basically to allow the government to arrest some people and let others go. And there's some money going back and forth there. And at the same time, we're hearing that that Bukele has referred to himself as the cool dictator.
Correct. There are many things that the current Salvadorian president refers himself as, but I think he really would like people to think of him as a president that is strict and follows the law, and El Salvador will be a very, you know, law-abiding country. And I think you'll find that if you look close enough, is anything but that.
And so we're speaking with Marco Aguirre, who is a, can I call you a Salvadoran immigrant? Although
yep, you're absolutely, I am. Yeah, I'm a Salvadoran immigrant.
Who is actually strongly connected to the sister city of Madison, Arquetao, and we're talking about what's happening right now in El Salvador in connection with these deportations and the new immigration crackdown happening in the U.S. And I am curious about, because some of the coverage I've read talks about there are human rights organizations in El Salvador who are doing their best to monitor this and speak out and try to hold the Bukele administration accountable and get more information. Do you have any information about them and how that process is going?
Yeah, I follow closely basically the efforts to to work for the release of people that have been imprisoned unfairly in El Salvador. And there is organizations, although the government has tried really hard to silence them. There's, in fact, one of the advocates for unfairly imprisoned people was arrested last month in El Salvador. He had been previously arrested and tortured, and he was arrested once again for advocating and for telling his story. It is extremely hard because the judicial system has been taken over by the executive branch. It is akin to the U.S. president basically firing all the Supreme Court justices and installing new ones that were to his favor. So this is why it's a huge challenge to have any sort of impact on El Salvador.
And how, if in any way, are the folks in Arquetao being affected by this? Are there people there who have been sometimes caught up in these roundups?
Yeah, one of the things that happened that you know, when there was a big crackdown against gang members, was that a state of exception was installed in the country, and that meant most of civil liberties could be ignored by the police and the army, and people who, whether there was any real connection or not to gangs, could be arrested. A lot of people from Arquetao were imprisoned and sent to jail. We actually have the son of one of our sister city involved people in Arquetao who was arrested. It has been 3 years since he's been in jail. The family has absolutely no information about him. The family cannot have any contact with him. And he has not been accused of a crime, and yet he remains in jail to this day.
And back to the Sister City project right now, are there plans for a delegation to go down and visit in the near future? That already happened this year.
It actually is today. Yesterday and today, they're flying. Yeah, one of our members is going along with a delegation of 8-9 people and are going to be there today, and the rest of the group will be there tomorrow.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing what they come back with, or even while they're there, if you hear information that we might be able to follow up on here. But I'm curious about, perhaps it's separate from, but in the context of all this going on, what can you tell me about what the Sister City Project is involved in right now? When folks go down there, what is that trip like? How are they helping out or being involved in what's happening in the city?
So the Sister City Project, much like when it started, it tries to make the things that are happening in Arquetao more visible, because just like when the Civil War was happening and the Sister City started, U.S. citizens tend to have a little more visibility in my country, and that's the intention. By bringing people over and having people over go to Arquetao and have conversations with the people who are living the reality, we're hoping that, like you said, the people who go into delegation can come back and tell the story, or while they're there, they can talk to other people and make them aware that the reality there is very different to what you hear in media, and how people might pretend to be extremely happy. And the reality is much different.
And so I'm curious about whether, in light of all that's going on, you know, this effort that seems both in El Salvador and now here to basically invoke fear about people's status as residents here or as immigrants here, are you yourself at all concerned about where this might go? Because a lot of the reporting I'm hearing right now is people are saying, well, they're coming for those people now and they might come for me next. And, you know, what category you find yourself in?
I think, yes, of course. I think one of the things that one of the reasons why I find this deportation of Venezuelans so concerning is because there was absolutely no process in finding these people guilty. People will say they were absolutely guilty, but there was no judicial process. I am a U.S. citizen now. However, I am naturalized. I do not count myself as somebody who would be completely immune to these things happening. I think part of the danger that people should realize is that there was no process behind deporting these people, much like they were deported. They could accuse me, they could accuse my brother, they could accuse my friends of being gang members, and I would be sent back to El Salvador without any recourse.
Yeah, it's interesting that on
the accusation of gang members. I heard an interview recently with, I think it's the new Homeland Security secretary here on National Public Radio, being basically quizzed about this current situation, about why these particular and how these particular deportees are being sent to El Salvador. And the answers seem to be to focus on tattoos, okay? Correct. That if you have a tattoo of a particular kind, then a decision is made that means you are a gang member. And that's reason enough, just because you went to a tattoo parlor and got something on your arm.
Yeah, and one of the things that is coming out now that the identities of the Venezuelan deported is that their family are actually showing their pictures and showing that tattoos are maybe their name of a daughter, the name of a relative, and there's nothing to do with gangs. You know, there's absolutely no reason. And I think the main purpose of this is to make the public desensitized about deporting people. If you can deport people and claim they're gang members, it's very easy for people to just shrug and go on with their day.
Right, because the statements that are coming out of the administration here, and I suppose that in San Salvador, Bukele is just echoing this right now, that all we have to do is say that these are bad and evil people and start listing all of these crimes that they have supposedly committed, and we don't have any evidence.
And I think that's part of why El Salvador was chosen, because there was already this state of exception that meant if you have tattoos, you could go to jail. So much like Venezuelans being accused of being gang members for having tattoos, Salvadorians are already in jail for having just had a tattoo.
Really? Yes. I think that's something that we've not heard so much about, how that connection has made it easier. To basically have an agreement with Bukele, between Trump and Bukele. Okay, the tattoo thing has worked for rounding up people in San Salvador. Let's see if we can try it here, and we'll pay you a bunch of money to lock them up.
Correct. And that's been, the way that the Salvadorian government got away with it is because they continue to have this state of exception that allows them to hold these people regardless of accusations. So we have a problem here where the legal process was not followed. But once they got to El Salvador, El Salvadorian state of exception meant they didn't have to respond to any sort of judge. They didn't have to respond to any sort of legal process, so they can be held much like other Salvadorians were held for having a tattoo or for somebody accusing them without any proof.
And back a little bit for a moment to the prison itself. And you know people who have been in and out. Have you actually met people who have been in and never gotten out?
I know people who've gotten in. One of the very hard things...
But they're still in, the people that you know.
Yes, the people that I know are still in. And one of the problems is that it is very hard to know where people are being held. There's many prisons and people get moved without notice, without anybody telling you anything.
So they might be moved from this, because the image that we're getting in a lot of the news coverage is there's pictures of this huge complex of barracks and prison buildings, and claims that there are up to 30 or 40,000 people being held there. But you're saying they can also be moved to different places.
Absolutely. And yeah. I've known people who've been in the prison system and got released who were moved 3-4 times to different prisons, where it'll be absolutely arbitrary. You'll be moved in the middle of the night. And I've heard them firsthand tell me the conditions and how they could hear the torture inside those prisons.
Yeah. And so, what we've been hearing in mainstream news about how the broader Salvadoran society feels about the impact that this roundup and this huge number of people in prison has affected them in a positive way by making things safer. So I get the sense that there is still at least a minority of these human rights groups who are trying to talk about what is the real trade-off between locking all these people up and being able to walk down the street without having a gang member threaten you.
Yeah, and I think this, my country was being held in conditions of, you know, of being, there were parts of the country that were being held by gangs. There is no question about that. There's also no question that a lot of the gang members were imprisoned, and people are thankful that there are no more gang members in the streets. However, the violence that was perpetrated by the gangs is basically now being perpetrated by the security system of the country, because now they're not only did they round up all the gang members, they're rounding up innocent people. And the news that you might hear that people are extremely happy might be also the fact that people are scared of speaking up and saying, my loved one is in prison without any justification.
Right. So there is this sense of fear that maybe driving that it's better to just put up and shut up, I guess.
And the people who have spoken up, I have personal friends who've been run out of the country with threats of imprisonment because they spoke up.
So, Marco, as we arrive at the last 5 minutes of our conversation, you have made it clear that you feel it's important to speak out about what's happening there, and we've been doing that for the last 20 or 25 minutes. Why do you feel it's important to speak out now, and why do you think it's important for others to find ways to speak out in the same way?
I think it's very important right now, because regardless of your opinion of immigration, the fact that we're arriving at a point in which civil liberties are being threatened, not just of people who you might consider to be illegal immigrants or people who should be deported or not. I think the fact that civil liberties are being threatened, everybody should take a stand and say, this is not okay. I think due process is really important in a democracy. And I think people need to realize that what is happening is not just people being deported. Is very similar to what happened in 2001 with what they called extraordinary rendition, sending people to dark prisons out of the country to be tortured. And I think it's what started is very similar to that now. And I think we should all be aware that this is happening now.
I guess in the last couple of minutes, also talking about that comparison back to 2001, the use of Guantanamo at that time, when people were being held there, maybe, as you said, in dark prisons in other parts of the world as well, it almost seems like El Salvador is kind of, through Bukele, is stepping up to provide basically a Guantanamo for the U.S. to send its prisoners to.
Yeah, definitely. I think if anything, we should have learned from Guantanamo being... having so many people that have absolutely nothing to do with the intended purpose of those prisons, we should realize that this is happening one more time. And it's a very, very troublesome situation now.
Well, Marco, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us on this edition of the Worldview feature. Marco Aguirre, who is from El Salvador, a resident of Madison and connected with the Madison Arquetau Sister City Project. And we look forward to talking to you and others from Sister City Group when they get back from El Salvador. Maybe we'll get some update.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, and I appreciate the time.
And that's Worldview for this week. Thank you to Marco for coming into the studio to talk with us. You can find more information about the Madison Arquetau Sister City Group and their current trip to El Salvador on their website, which is www.mascp.org. And that's Madison Area Sister City Project, so mascp.org. And thank you to the Worldview Collective members, Neil Adams, Sabi Etiye, Chuck Benish, Andrew Karn, Gil Halstead, and Abhitab Paul, for bringing international news to WORT listeners. And thanks also to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Sholly Pittman. And we especially thank you, our listeners, for listening to us. Please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORT FM .org or on the app. And now, stay tuned for Salamat.
For over 10 years, Mama Cares has been there for local musicians in their time of need, whether to help with medical expenses or other personal calamities. Madison Area Music Association invites you to Mama Cares' 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon, featuring live performances by Sam Ness, Gin Chocolate and Bottle Rockets, and The Jimmies. Help your local musicians and enjoy some live music at the Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. You're listening to WORT Madison.
In Arabic, we say, Sam, Sam, Futter ala Basali.
Translation.